Okay, so if we're talking about building a socialist alternative to Rudd's Labour, like Marx, any Marxist, you have to start from the reality. You have to start not from what you wish, but from what is. And so I'm going to spend quite a lot of this talk just talking about what is the political situation that we face at the moment. Because if we can't get that right, then any amount of working out what it is we should do will obviously be building on sand. So let's go back to the election. Seems a long time ago now, but it's not that long ago, is it? November the 24th last year? And remind ourselves what the election was about. Firstly, I think it's very clear that the focus of the election was anti-Howard. The focus of the election was hostility to Howard and what he represented, all of the sort of things that had made people angry for years and years, rather than great hopes in the incoming Labor government. And, of course, just to emphasise that, the Labor Party themselves, I think, went to considerable lengths in the election campaign to downplay expectations of change. Their real campaign slogan, or not the one they actually campaigned on, but the sort of hidden agenda, if you like, was, "We're not John Howard." But there's no denying what the election itself represented. It was a watershed. It was the culmination, if you like, of a whole series of things, and it represented a really significant change in what people thought about Australian society. But it didn't just come out of the election. Election results are never just things that pop out of the air. It reflected a longer-term shift to the left, a whole series of social attitude surveys that have been taken by, you know, the ANU, there's a school or something there that has been doing these social attitude surveys for years now. Consistently, people moving to the left on a whole series of issues about, you know, does big business have too much power, those kind of things. What kind of society they want to live in terms of demands for more social services. On the other hand, surveys done by Unions New South Wales about union membership. Union membership, as comrades know, is in the low 20s now. The low 20% of the workforce are actually union members. The Unions New South Wales survey showed something much more significant. They asked people, would you like to be in a union? And the figures were double the actual union membership figures. All of this gives us a feel for that shift to the left, which, in a way, the election result is just an indicator of. And because of all of this, there have been a range of changes made by Rudd in the first few months. They reflect, in other words, the Labor Party's recognition of the shift that the election kind of summed up. Think about one of the first things that they did after they got elected was to sign the Kyoto Protocol. Things that, you know, Howard had made a kind of a point of honour, never signing that. No, they signed that. Kevin Rudd sent his new MPs out to do something very soon after they first started work. They had to go and visit homeless shelters. They had to show that they were a bit more humane than, or even a bit more human, than the Liberal Party politicians that had preceded them. That the case of Mohammed Haneef, that the previous government had said, if this guy gets off, we're going to appeal and so on. Chris Evans gets up, I think it was Chris Evans, and announces that they're going to drop the appeal, that Mohammed Haneef's case is going to be over. He is not going to be pursued and persecuted any longer. A couple of other changes, which I won't include in this list, but are worth mentioning, and they're of a different order, I think, because they indicate something about some of the constraints that Labor faces in making changes to relate to the broader sentiment. They have just in the last week put legislation through Parliament that said there will be no new AWAs, no more of those individual contracts so centrally associated with work choices. There will be no more of those created. And they've made the announcement, again, quite early on after the election, of some troops being withdrawn from Iraq by the middle of the year. But I think if there's anything that sums up this period, it's the apology to the stolen generations. Because I think it's a key indicator of how the Labor government's had to respond. It's an important symbolic victory, I think, for struggle. And we should keep that in mind, that all of these things, there is struggle behind these things. None of this is Labor just pulling these things out of the air and saying, oh, here's something nice we'll give to the people because they seem a bit more left-wing these days. The apology would not have happened without the refusal of Aboriginal people to be silenced. And it's not really, even though the apology is about the question of the stolen generations, I don't think we should see it as just about the question of the stolen generations. The years of campaigning on deaths in custody, on questions of land rights, on all of the sort of the racism against Aboriginal people in all its forms, the fact that that campaigning has kept going meant that Rudd's speech was much beyond just the kind of formal wording of the apology itself. You think about the things that were in the speech. It attacked the idea that the policies against the policies that resulted in the stolen generations were somehow a mistake, that they explicitly acknowledged this was conscious government policy. It acknowledged all kinds of mistreatment up to the 1970s, again, not just the question of stealing of Aboriginal children from their families. The massively hostile response that there was to what was rightly described by one Aboriginal woman as Nelson's toxic speech showed that right-wingers in Australian society have been further marginalised. He couldn't get away with it. And support for the apology was both broad in the lead-up to the apology, but even more significant, support for the apology after it was made went up. So that's all to the good. On the other hand, I think the limits of what Labor is offering were also made clear by the apology. He deliberately didn't mention anything about compensation in the speech, and the reason for that was the week previously, the Labor Party government had announced that this apology would have no connection to any compensation for the stolen generations. He didn't mention the word genocide, and therefore, as Aboriginal activist Michael Mansell pointed out, there was no explanation for why these policies were pursued. The bipartisan war cabinet on Aboriginal issues, which Rudd is promoting, is not at all positive. Involving the Liberals in this, all this bipartisanship, oh yeah, we're all in it together, what does it actually mean? Involving the Liberals in dealing with Aboriginal issues is just an excuse for Labor Party inaction, because it says, oh, we're only going to do what Nelson will agree to, the guy that made that appalling speech. And so the apology both confirms and strengthens widespread confidence, though, that the Howard era is over. I think it's such a decisive symbol of that, and that people have a right to expect better than was on offer then. And so to try and sum up the political situation, we're looking at both continuity and change from the Howard era. None of the key anti-Howard issues have gone away in their entirety. There's the war, there's climate change, there's the refusal on the ban on same-sex marriage, there's issues to do with the workplace and industrial relations, there's the racist intervention into Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory, there's general hostility to neoliberalism, to all of the things about the inequalities in society, the cuts to welfare, the appalling state of the health system in a range of states. All of those things are still there in some form or other. But there's nothing automatic about people's hostility around these issues. There's nothing automatic about that translating to hostility to the Labor government, at least in the short term. People are not hostile to the government per se in the same way as they were hostile to Howard in the past. So there won't be, at the moment, there isn't a hate figure to focus on, at least, you know, at least for now. People will hope that at least something will be different, something will be better with the change of government. And in fact, I think this is really widespread. I was in a taxi the other day with Zodwa going somewhere in Sydney doing a bit of tourism. And the taxi driver, we're just having a talk about how the world is. And he was quite cynical, you know, politicians, all the same and so on. But I think it was a perfect example of this. You've got to give them some time. That we've got to have, you know, I don't believe any politicians are any good, but these ones, they're not John Howard, and we have to see how they go. Give them a bit of time to show what they're going to do. But again, it's important to remember this wait and see attitude does not mean enthusiastic endorsement of Rudd's policies. How long the wait and see attitude lasts, we don't know. It depends on a range of things. It depends on what Rudd does, depends on how the economy performs, depends on international issues. If there is, you know, an attack on Iran, for example, that could change the picture entirely. But of course, we can't know any of these things. The key continuity, though, that I think is worth drawing out is that Rudd will still be overseeing a government with essentially the same program for Australian capitalism as Howard had. Package it as they might, and they haven't really done that much to try and package it when you think about it. From the outset, Rudd proudly proclaimed his fiscal conservatism. This means surplus budgets, just like under the Howard, in the Howard era, limits on government spending, no plans to attack the growing inequalities in Australia. You think about some of the examples. I was looking this up the other day. They're going to be childcare rebates, and like the tax cuts, they will be skewed towards the people who are the best off. But I did find a limit on the childcare rebates. If your partner earns over $250,000 a year, then you won't get it. So that, I think, is a kind of a summary of the commitment to dealing with the inequalities in Australian society. It's kind of small. You think about the upcoming budget. There's been all kinds of rumours, and I don't think that, you know, what's going to be in the budget. Again, we don't know. The rumours are just that, rumours, and they've been denied, and except, you know, new ones come up and so on. But what we can say is all of the budget rumours have been negative from the point of view of workers and the oppressed. The one area of guaranteed growth in the upcoming budget is what? Yes, military spending, defence. One example of, they've already put the money out for this one, they're going to get 100 F-35 Joint Strike Fighters at the tiny bargain basement price of $15 billion. So the point I'm trying to get at here is that there are contradictions for Labor built into this situation. They have to relate on the one hand to a mood for change, and they have to rule for the bosses. So, and you can see how this plays out, I think, if you look at what's happened with the way that they've dealt with work choices. There's no doubt whatsoever. This was the key issue in the election. Everyone recognises, even some of, you know, most of the Liberal Party recognised it eventually. So what have they done? The change they've made, the thing that went through Parliament this week, no new AWAs, but the existing AWAs will last. And that means some of them will be in existence in 2012. But more important than that, I think, they're maintaining the core of work choices. New label, but the core of work choices. Workers who want to fight will actually come up against the same phalanx of laws that outlaw strikes pretty much all the time except in the bargaining period. And even then, they can outlaw them during the bargaining period if it's in the national interest or other things like that. The core things of work choices that oblige bosses to refuse all pay to anyone who's involved in illegal industrial action, such as bans. So if you put an overtime ban on under work choices, it was illegal for the boss to pay you for the 8 hours of the day you'd already worked. That will remain. To hold a legal strike, unions will still have to waste tens of thousands of dollars on undemocratic secret ballots, and workers will be denied the democratic right to meet and decide collectively what action they support. Union organisers still won't have the rights to go into workplaces. And, of course, the Star Chamber in the building industry, the Australian Building and Construction Commission, will, again, continue to operate until it's absorbed into one of the new institutions that the Labor Industrial Relations Policy is going to set up. And so that's, I think, that contradiction relating to the mood for change, making a change about AWAs, on the other hand, ruling for the bosses, making sure that Australian capitalism in the class struggle, that the government is going to make sure they're on their side and not ours. And I think we can see the limitations on other fronts as well. I mentioned before the apology to the stolen generations, resolutely attached to there will be no monetary compensation. The racist intervention into the Northern Territory Aboriginal communities has just been rolled out into more communities in the Northern Territory. More people are having 50% of their welfare quarantined. What a lovely euphemism. Yeah. You know, return to the ration system, bit of flour, sugar and tea. People are not deemed to be fit and adult enough to look after their own money. That's what the quarantining of welfare means. That's being spread into more Northern Territory communities, and it's also being extended to Aboriginal people in a number of other states. Think about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and the US alliance. Again, no change on this. There will be, well, I shouldn't say no change, there will be, as I said before, some Australian troops in Iraq withdrawn. But there will remain a large number of Australian troops in various functions in Iraq, and more Australian Federal Police are being sent to Afghanistan. You think about I mentioned that they dropped the appeal against Mohammed Hanif being deemed a free and innocent person. They've set up an inquiry, though, into how it was that he came to be persecuted in the first place. But I don't think the Federal Police and ASIO have too much to worry about. This inquiry has got fewer powers than Howard's inquiry into the Australian Wheat Board. And let's not forget the War on Terror in its local form, that the War on Terror will continue in an ideological form. It will continue with the resulting demonisation of Muslims. You think about the current terror trials in Melbourne and Sydney as, I think, a really concrete example. Those men, 21 men in two cities who have now been locked up for over 2 years, and they've been, what's happened to them? What have they done? Nothing. But they've had 2 years jail already. Talk about prejudging your guilt. And then, of course, there's the state of the world economy. If a world recession takes hold this year, even if it takes some time to affect Australia, this could force Rudd to push in more unpopular directions. And we've seen, again, some evidence of this, even the looming economic problems. You know, Australia is not in recession. Nobody's saying anything like that. But the looming problems on the horizon, the clouds on the US horizon, if you like, those have caused Rudd and Gillard to start talking pretty much immediately about wage restraint, the need for wage restraint. On the other hand, they haven't been so worried that they've caused them to budge on tax cuts for the rich. Even before the talk of recession, though, on these economic questions, we've seen that they're continuing a range of things to do that really constitute part of the Howard legacy. Rudd's continuing Howard's subsidy on to the private health industry. His education revolution does not include the abolition or even the reduction of HECS. Mm. And Gillard, let's just see how revolutionary this revolution is. Gillard announced a review of higher education to deliver what she called, I think kind of misnamed, Priority Action Plan by October. And a full report by the end of the year. That is, this is going to mean that there will be the outcome of the education revolution, if there is to be any funding, and there's no guarantee of that. If there is to be any funding, the outcome will be budget next year at the earliest. And let's just see what the terms of reference again for this priority action plan are. Improving the sector's contribution to economic productivity and workforce needs. And the final thing, the ACTU's claim for a $26 increase in the minimum wage. Will the government back the claim? No. If the economy goes into recession, and that's an if which I don't propose to discuss, this can accelerate the process. It could mean that there will be attempts to enforce the wage restraint that at the moment they're just raising as an issue, that they're already saying there is no money available for any public service wage rise. It's been announced that if any public sector, any public service department gives in to union demands for a wage increase, they'll have to find the money from within the department, because the government is making sure that there's going to be no funding for any wage increases get granted. They're trying to give a bit of backbone to the public service bosses in the negotiations with the unions. The Razor Gang proposed through welfare spending. And, of course, if the economy did actually go into recession, the possibility of finding that money that seems so elusive for many other things to bail out certain bosses. All of this will jar a lot more if unemployment is rising, home repossessions are increasing, and so on. But we can't telescope the pace of events. We don't know when this will happen, the way that it will play out. We should know. Revolutionaries need to know in order to, you know, strengthen our argument about the nature of the Labor Party, why Labor governs for the bosses and so on. We need to know the history of the Scull and Labor government in 1929. How unlucky for them. They finally got into government and then the world economy's cactus. Yeah. And they do a whole series of things. They cut wages. They take the sort of anti-working class measures that the ruling class demands when its system goes into crisis. So we need to know about the Scullin government. We should not be going around saying Rudd's just like Scullin. In a general sense, he is, but he hasn't done any of these things yet. We can't telescope the pace of events. So to try and sum up the situation and move on a bit quicker. Okay, firstly, there, I think, out of the election, hopes for change, optimism about other people. I think that's one of the most important things that came out of the election. The feeling that other people aren't all shit Howard lovers. and yet me and all my friends, we never loved him. Well, that was always a mad position to have in some ways. That optimism about other people, I think, is an important outcome of the election because it's been raised. But in the long run, Labor-run Australian capitalism can no more satisfy these hopes than could Howard. Secondly, what has held the ALP back? The arguments about why the ALP couldn't possibly have more radical positions in the run-up to the election and so on has not been the conservatism of Labor voters, but Labor's desire to serve the bosses. Because their role is to run Australian capitalism, where Labor has made a clear-cut shift to the left to relate to the mass sentiment, they've done it on issues that won't upset the bosses. You think about it. The apology, it was cheap because there's no money. Think about signing Kyoto. Was that accompanied by any genuine reforms or determination to make the polluting big businesses pay? Not on your life. So they've made some shifts to the left in the sense of relating to mass sentiment, but they've done it fairly. They've done it in a fairly targeted way. And that means that there'll be no shortage of things that people dislike. War, racism, privatisation, appalling health systems, massive CEO payments, banks raising interest rates even more than the Reserve Bank raises them, and so on. And that's all if the recession doesn't hit. There'll be just as many issues for socialists to campaign around, but it will not just be a continuation of the situation under Howard. How much and how soon workers will blame Rudd for this is another question, let alone whether it will translate into strikes and mass demonstrations. So I want to move on to say a little bit about what needs to happen to move this forward. The key to resistance remains, as it did before the election, mass working class action. How long the honeymoon lasts and how Rudd responds could be influenced significantly by what the union officials do. But on this front, there's no grounds for optimism at the moment. The weaknesses that were displayed by union officialdom in the campaign against work choices remain. With very few exceptions, there is not even verbal resistance to Rudd and Gillard, although it was very pleasing to see Charon Burrow, the head of the ACTU, get stuck in when they made the call for wage restraint by saying, well, how about a bit of profit restraint? But that's the exception rather than the rule at the moment. When the CFMEU said they would take industrial action to get back wages that were lost under work choices, a marvellous sentiment, Gillard went for them. And they largely backed down. Oh, no, we're not talking about anything illegal. Oh, it's just the next round of enterprise bargaining and so on. So any idea that the union leaders have shifted away from the kind of policies that they had in the run-up to the election, I think we've got no evidence for that at the moment. And so in the longer term, in terms of what needs to happen to move things forward, in the longer term, the only answer is to rebuild a layer of socialist militants in the union movement to turn around weakened trade union organisation and to generate the kind of industrial action that workers can actually assert their rights with. But that's in the longer term. This doesn't mean that nothing can happen in the short term. It's not like there's no resistance. You look at the strikes against Labor state governments, for example, in a range of states now, demos on a number of issues. Just in the week leading up to Marxism, a lot of us have been at both an anti-war rally and a student rally, in the single week leading up to Easter. So there are strikes, there are demonstrations on a range of issues that are going to continue, even if the demonstrations themselves are not huge. And one further thing, with Labor in government everywhere, in every state and federally, the answer now cannot be, oh, we should just wait for the election of a Labor government. So that opens up some possibilities, not necessarily automatically of action, but some possibilities of argument at least. Which takes me to the final section of what I want to say, which is the possibilities to build a socialist alternative to Labor. There are people who want an alternative. They want answers to their questions about why the things they hate happen, why things just keep getting worse, how a better world can ever come about. And I suspect that some of these questions are more sharply posed in people's minds because, again, of all the talk about recession. The ALP, we should remind ourselves, is well to the right of the mass of people. Polls consistently show substantial support for workers' rights, support for Aboriginal rights and refugees, and hostility to big business. The distance between the masses of people and the new government's policies opens a space potentially to the left of Labor. The issues that we know people hate, like war, poverty, racism, will continue to open some people up to the argument that a better world is both necessary and possible. You think about questions of class, like spiralling executive salaries. We're not going to see the end of that under the new government. Executive salaries, you know, they don't even seem to have any shame of announcing it or anything like that. That continues to be the case. And the growing divide between rich and poor, again, when A Current Affair and Today Tonight, those not very left-wing Current Affairs programs, when they have item after item about the growing gap between rich and poor, you can tell that something's going on beyond just, you know, our wishes of, you know, capitalism exposing itself. The system is rotten, and even its boosters have to indicate that rottenness in some way if they're to remain in contact with their audience. And so all of this exists whether or not there are demonstrations or strikes or other forms of activities. All the fears and uncertainties about a possible recession, the subprime mortgage disaster, the flow-ons from that, also provide opportunities to raise the viciousness of the system. There's a period, I think, it's already begun, I think, a period of some degree of ideological turmoil, because the question of can capitalism work, not can socialism work, can capitalism work, that question is posed, I think, more sharply in the mass media and so on now than in the past. So we need to make arguments using all of this. We need to use the examples of the huge payouts to the directors of Macquarie Bank to highlight the priorities of capitalism and explain that it's a product of the massive attacks on workers' rights. Where did their money come from? Actually, it came from workers producing those profits in the first place. And the logic of a system that's based on the exploitation of workers and the drive to maximise those profits. So it means a range of things. It means keeping up to date with what's going on in the world. So when news of something like the Business Review Weekly's latest rich list comes out, we should be on that like a shot, because we grab hold of the issue to illustrate how capitalism works and to help convince people of the need to build a socialist alternative to labour. In many ways, the situation won't be drastically different to last year, but it's not the same. We have to take the new political situation into account. And this doesn't mean we're just sitting around waiting for Labor to commit some atrocity so we can then say, look, they've exposed themselves. What if there's a period where there aren't any new atrocities, that Labor just, you know, has a period where they don't do anything particularly overtly bad? You know, they're going on ruling for the bosses, that's always bad, but no particular issue comes out. For instance, what about something positive like the apology to the Stolen Generations? We don't say, oh, well, it's the Labor Party ruling for capitalism, we denounce this. Not if we don't want to actually talk to anyone left-wing, we don't. If Rudd says he'll make some minor reform, we'll point out the things that he could do but isn't. The apology is fantastic, but what about dispossession, genocide, racism? What about these issues? So much for, you know, the mantra that Jenny Macklin came out with after the apology of, oh, we're going to close the gap, close the gap, close the gap. That was obviously the spin doctor thing of that's your soundbite for this one, Jenny. But really, close the gap, and yet what's the gap that's opening up in terms of poverty for Aboriginal people in the Northern Territory as we speak? The gap that's opening up is the gap that happens when you don't get 50% of the miserable welfare payments that is all the government will give you anyway. So if something positive happens, we can still respond to that, because there'll always be more. On the campuses, we'll argue that the Labor government should reinstate funding to student unions. We'll argue that they should get rid of HECS, that we should have a system where people actually can get education not on the basis of their wealth. We'll argue that the anti-terror laws should be scrapped entirely, that all troops should come home immediately from both Iraq and Afghanistan. You see my point. These arguments are there to be made, and the change of government hasn't made a massive difference in that regard. There's no point in sitting on our hands waiting for Labor to do something terrible. If Rudd does nothing grossly objectionable and there are no international events to provoke a political furor, there will still be plenty of issues, and all of them, we can make the argument, are products of capitalism. We need to show, therefore, the things that we've always had to argue with people about over some years now, that capitalism's relentless drive for profit leads in turn to environmental destruction and to brutal imperialist wars like those in Afghanistan and Iraq. We need to argue that Labor's commitment to capitalism makes it incapable of defending working class interests and this means we need to build a socialist alternative to the Labor Party. We need to convince people that capitalism is the reason that all of these horrors happen and that workers have the power to win reforms and ultimately that workers have the power to overthrow the whole system. And this raises the thing I want to end on. I think it's appropriate, given that we're at a conference called Marxism, it raises the importance of Marxist theory in politics. We need to discuss the historical examples that demonstrate our arguments to win people to a general worldview. Why you need to be a Marxist, why we need to build a socialist organisation now. You think about that, one of the reasons why we need to know is not just that because it's good to be clever, or it's good to be a kind of smartass that can, you know, answer people's questions at dinner parties or something like that. There's a more important reason in terms of all of this stuff, all of the knowledge that we try and gather. It's about looking outwards. It's about trying to convince other people not to perfect ourselves as human beings, but to build an organisation that's got more people in it. And so if there are not examples of struggle going on at the moment to illustrate our arguments about socialism from below, then historical knowledge becomes even more important. That to be able to say to people, this is what I was at this session in this room just before about Fred Patterson, Australia's only communist member of parliament. And lots of comrades never heard of this guy. But actually the point of the talk was Australian workers are not these irredeemable conservatives that are always, you know, run away from revolutionary ideas. They bloody voted for him. Louise gave the example as two towns in North Queensland, one of which in the election where Patterson got elected, I think it was at that election, one of them, nobody out of a town of hundreds of people, nobody voted for the Conservatives, and the other town, 14 people did. This is towns you have 900 people in the town. So I think, you know, that historical knowledge, it's not just, oh, it's interesting to know this sort of stuff, but it's part of a campaign that we have to wage to convince other people that the working class can actually change the world. If people don't see workers standing up for their rights, then theory to back up the historical knowledge, the argument, why is the working class central to changing the world? Why can't some other force, why can't guerrillas, you know, why couldn't the ANC end apartheid and capitalism? Those sort of arguments are also central to understanding what we need to do to build a bigger socialist alternative. Okay, so building a socialist alternative is not something that can be put off to the future. A strong socialist organisation with a base in the unions could have made a real difference in the campaign against work choices and in the student campaign against VSU. So we can't wait. We have to build the organisation now. I don't know if there's anyone here who's not a member of Socialist Alternative. If you aren't a member yet, I encourage you to join. But actually, for the people who are members, part of this stuff is about getting ourselves to understand how the world works, to understand what we need to do, to see that we're in it for the long haul. Because I think that's part of what, you know, understanding Marxist politics is about as well. We have to understand and be able to analyse the situation that we're in, work out what to do, and then go out and do what needs to be done. And that's something we're going to have to do between now and the revolution. I think it's something that it's worth committing ourselves to. So I'll leave it there.